This talk is offered by Ordinary Mind Zendo. Ordinary Mind was founded by Barry Magid, Dharma heir of Charlotte Joko Beck, and is dedicated to her vision of a psychologically minded Zen practice adapted to the needs of American students practicing in the context of their everyday lives. Our public programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
I've been reading about the life of David Hume, the 18th century Scottish philosopher, particularly his friendship with his contemporary Adam Smith. And while we now think of Smith primarily as the author of The Wealth of Nations and think of him as an economist, for most of his life, Smith and Hume were engaged in moral philosophy, and Smith wrote a first book called The Theory of Moral Sentiments, for which he was known for most of his life. I think that was published in his 30s, and Wealth of Nations didn't come out until his 50s. And each of them had a project of essentially trying to ground morality and ethics in psychology rather than in religion or revelation of any kind. Hume was quite notoriously outspoken against religion and got known as the great infidel for his trouble. Smith was much more circumspect and as a result was able to spend a lot of his life as a university professor in the days when the church had veto power over such appointments. Hume could never get such a job. But in both cases, each in their own way, they wanted to ground morality in what we would call empathy. The word in the 18th century that they used was sympathy. But it largely meant imaginatively entering into the world of the other so that you could understand how things felt from their point of view. And they felt that to really understand and feel the suffering of another was sufficient to be the basis of our sense of right and wrong. Now, Hume in particular in his complaints against religion, he argued not only against notions of a creator and of miracles and things like that, but he was very dismissive of what he called the monkish virtues. And in a certain sense, there was a little bit of wiggle room in those days. If you denounced monkish virtues, you were denouncing something about Roman Catholicism, which wasn't a bad thing to denounce in Presbyterian Scotland, which was, you know, fanatical and grim in its own way, but they, you know, could unite in not liking Catholics. So if you denounced monkish virtues, you were talking about something that reached its apex in Catholic monasticism. And so he described it this way. He said, not only are the monkish virtues not virtues, but men of sense will regard them as vices because they cross or contradict all desirable ends, stupefying the understanding and hardening the heart, obscure the fancy and sour the temper. He includes under the monkish virtues celibacy, fasting, penance, mortification, self-denial, humility, silence, and solitude. Now, it's an interesting list. You might find yourself agreeing with them at the beginning, not wanting to have much to do with celibacy or mortification. But then starting to say, what about humility, silence, and solitude? It's interesting. Part of his complaint about these things was that he thought our virtues were deeply social. And this he was like Aristotle, who said man is a political animal, who put friendship at the top of his list of virtues, and who thought the virtues of prudence and wisdom and courage and such forth could only develop socially. Hume was like that, in that he sort of felt that in order to really flourish as a human being, you couldn't cut yourself off from other people. So solitude and silence was a kind of emasculation. It's a kind of cutting off part of yourself from development because you avoid contact with others. Hume himself was a very outgoing and well-liked and happy person. The way some years ago the Theravadan monk Matthew Picard got labeled the world's happiest man because of his EEG results. If you asked people in the 18th century to nominate someone like that, they might have nominated Hume. He was really known for this kind of very open, positive disposition. And it created a lot of problems for people that he, was an atheist. They couldn't believe that he could be at peace with himself and not worry about damnation. This particularly drove Boswell quite crazy and kept expecting Hume to, convert on his deathbed, and such things like that. So Hume's denunciation of the monkish virtues might remind us of going back to Machiavelli, back further to Aristotle and his sense of virtues being social, and then later to Nietzsche, who also wanted to denounce the Christian virtues. And Machiavelli and Nietzsche, in their own ways, sort of wanted to posit a set of heroic, Homeric virtues rather than the Christian ones. Hume, I say, is like closer to Aristotle, that he wants things to be social and gregarious. And if he is criticized today, I think It's also because, like Aristotle, he felt that a certain amount of wealth and social status was necessary for happiness and the cultivation of virtues. He had nothing against wealth, doing well in the world, and so sometimes his morality is you know, condemned now for being less preoccupied than we think he should with notions of inequality. But his big bugaboo was religious intolerance and fanaticism. Like Aristotle, his great virtue was moderation. And he was, in his lifetime, for most people, primarily known as a best-selling author of the history of England. And it was remarkable for its time in being very even-handed. It was not history written from a political, particular political point of view, but he really endeavored to use empathy and see the rationale and virtues of each position, and was thought to be remarkably fair and balanced for his day. The one thing he was always denouncing, though, is this kind of religious fanaticism that had, you know, in the previous centuries led to so many religious wars and conflicts. The one exception, which is interesting, is he said that in the 17th century, at the time of Charles I, the power of the monarchy had become so absolute and concentrated that the only way anybody would challenge it was if they were crazy religious fanatics like the Puritans. That in a certain sense, you had to be nuts to go up against the king. And so that he almost grudgingly said that religious fanaticism in that case led to the English Revolution and the establishment of parliamentary democracy. All this, in a way, is a long preamble to thinking about these lists of virtues and what do we think we're cultivating in practice here. And I thought about it particularly in comparison to the discussion we heard last week from Grace Shireson and about her training in a Rinzai temple in Japan. What are the virtues that are being cultivated there? There's certainly a whole list of monkish virtues, but they're a very different list. And when she describes her teacher, he would display many virtues of compassion and humility and humor. But that when she describes the training that the monks go through, it would seem to me that the overriding virtue is endurance. That endurance is a kind of gateway virtue. If you don't have that virtue, you're not going to be able to go through the training and develop any of the others. And each of these lists of virtues, whether it's Hume's list or the Rinzai list, I think are defined in their own way in terms of the corresponding vices, or what are the sins these virtues are designed to overcome. Christian virtues tended always to be organized around sins associated with sexuality. And so monks, the first monkish virtue on Hume's list is chastity, right? The first thing you got to do is get control of that, right? That's true in a lot of religious, monastic traditions, including Buddhism. But attachment and self-centeredness might be more prominent on the Buddhist list of vices to be overcome. Now, in each case, what I'd like to consider is the proposition that somehow we become virtuous only by winning the battle against some element in our nature that is sinful and or delusional, depending on how you, what tradition you're in and how you think about these things. And the metaphor of battle is very central to religious practices everywhere. The idea of killing the ego is found in all sorts of Buddhist stories. And you have, certainly with the story of Shakyamuni's original enlightenment, tales of, extreme mortification. You have to overcome attachment to the flesh and bodily needs, and certainly any kind of personal or emotional dependency or connection. Somehow all these things have to be stamped out before we can see reality as it is. Now, in general, from a contemporary psychological perspective, I would say that this whole metaphor of doing battle, the self doing battle with the self in pursuit of goodness or enlightenment, is the problem, not the solution. And that our traditions are saturated with what I think of as a kind of self-perpetuating fight against the self. That the very thing that we're trying to overcome gets built into the way we try to overcome it. Now, when I listened to Grace and read her description of Rinzai training, I would not deny at all that there's some people who come through that the way her teacher did, with qualities that are quite special and quite wonderful. But the idea that enlightenment, however we think about that, can only be achieved by people who can go through that strikes me as a pretty crazy idea. Einstein famously said, "I don't believe God plays dice with the universe." Well, I would say I don't believe God has created a world in which the truth about life and death and the nature of human happiness is only accessible to spiritual triathletes, right? That it's only people who can, this tiny minority of people who are able to push themselves to these absolute terrible limits, and like this description of the Sesshin of 7 days of sitting with no sleep whatsoever for 7 days, right? As this is the door you have to pass through. I just don't believe it. And one thing that I think we may explore more in the future is the way an alternative to that way of thinking emerged in medieval Buddhism. In the more or less in the 13th century, where Pure Land, Nichiren Ren, and Dogen all offered ways of thinking about enlightenment that were very different, and it was called sort of the original enlightenment movement. There's a very good book by Jacqueline Stone that I've been reading about that I may talk about in more detail another day. But a big push for this movement was a sense that enlightenment or salvation or something in Buddhism ought to be available to ordinary people and lay people, and that it should not be something that you cultivate over lifetimes, that you have to accumulate, you know, merit through, you know, endless reincarnations in order to finally reach Buddhahood, that it should not be something that is only attainable through exotic, esoteric, or ascetic practices of a few monks, but that there was this big movement that the recitation of the name of the Lotus Sutra or faith in the Pure Land of Amida Buddha, when you have that in the moment, you're already there, that there is not a world of attachment and a delusion to be overcome, but that this world is already nirvana, and that our practice is to be open to that at any moment. And I was struck by the way in which Dogen, when he talks about the identity of sitting in practice, the identity of enlightenment in Zazen itself, was very much part of this original enlightenment movement. Has a lot of ties to what was going on in these other sects. That, again, he's sort of saying, as soon as you sit down in Zazen, you're already manifesting the thing that you're seeking, right? It's right here in the midst of your Zazen that this is expressing, manifesting, being the very thing that you seek. Right, it's not an endless stepwise process or technique. It's right here and right now. So I think that all of this is sort of a long way of thinking about what it is that we think we're doing here. What is it that we think we're cultivating? What is it that we think that we're overcoming? Who do we think we already are?